Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Simon Cole, co-founder and chief executive of the music platform 7digital. After training at the BBC and working at Manchester's Piccadilly Radio, in 1989, Simon set up the Unique Broadcasting Company, which became the market leader in network radio production. His campaigns, including The Break with Kit Kat and The Pepsi Chart Show, are still recognised across the UK. Simon, thank you for joining me.
Great pleasure to be here, Paul.
So, Simon, how did you get from the Pepsi Chart Show to 7digital?
That's a big jump, and the answer to that was about...
We've got an hour, don't worry.
8 or 10 years.
We haven't got 8 or 10 years.
I have spent my entire life in the radio business. But the radio industry went through, and to some extent is still going through, an interesting transition after about 2005, I think, as digital came along. And the radio industry's attempt to reinvent itself digitally was not the reinvention that I or the company I was leading by that time, UBC Media, Unique had become UBC Media, was not the vision that we had for the digital radio industry. Digital in radio in the late 2000s sort of meant a digital version of what we already do, whereas I and some others believed digital meant beginning to do different things. So, for example, we believed that digital radios should be connected and there should be a return path, to use the technical jargon. So that, for example, one of the things we worked a great deal on was a service which would allow you to buy the song you were listening to by just pushing a button on the radio.
Great idea.
Yeah, we couldn't get arrested in the radio industry for that. And so I began to get quite frustrated with the way the business was going as a radio company. Equally, the margins, frankly, in radio production were flattening at best and receding in reality. And so you fast forward to, 2012-13.
A pivot was needed, as they call
it. And to be brutally blunt, I was, for the first time in my life, professionally not stimulated by what I was doing. And I began to think, well, what should I do? And the reality is, when you've been at that stage in the radio industry for nearly 30 years, the only thing people think you can do is radio. And I watched lots of colleagues of mine. At the time, the industry was sort of breaking up. This was when Chrysalis was changing, EMAP was being sold, Global Radio was coming in. There was an awful lot of transition. All the companies that were public radio companies that were publicly quoted had left the market. We were still on the market, not doing very well on the market. And so I was in a bit of a tight spot. And I thought, well, if I'm going to change, my professional life, I'm going to have to bring the company with me. And one of the things we'd got quite interested in, and as I say, this is back in 2012-13, was how the emerging streaming music industry was going to develop. And I had a belief at the time, which happily has turned out to be the case, that streaming music would end up actually sounding a lot like radio, and that radio would end up being a lot more online and be a lot more like streaming music, and that in the end, the marketplace for streamed entertainment services, if you like, would be a combination of streamed music and radio. At that time, we'd done some business with a company called 7digital, which was at the time run by a man called Ben Drury, who'd started it as a company powering download stores for record companies. That was its original purpose. And we'd come across 7digital through that work we did with the service I was talking about, which was called Click. And so I went to Ben. We had a joint shareholder, Imagination Technologies, who were one of the pioneers of producing digital radio devices. But they were also really interested in streamed music. So they'd become shareholders in 7digital, and they were also shareholders in UBC Media. And I was, I was at the Royal Opera House one night watching the ballet, which is a passion of mine, with Hussein, who at the time was the chief executive of Imagination. And I said to him, listen, I have this thing about 7digital and UBC, and I kind of think we're going to end up in the same place. And he was like, wow, well, I have exactly the same point of view. So why don't we look at, could we put the two companies together? So that was what we did. We reversed, to use the financial technical term, we reversed UBC into 7digital, created a new public company effectively called Seven Digital, which was a combination of the two companies. And 4 years later, that's what we are. So Seven Digital is a business-to-business operation which can produce you a radio program if you want, and we still produce, with the largest outsourced producer for the BBC, we produce Radcliffe and McConey on Six Music.
Great show.
Pick of the Pops, Sounds of the 60s.
Pick of the Pops.
Etc, etc. So we produce all of those shows. So we can do all of that creative stuff, but we also have a technology platform. We have a catalogue of 60 million songs, in other words, the record industry's catalogue. We ingest 200,000 new tracks a week. We can serve any of those tracks to any device in 60 countries in the world in less than 100 milliseconds. So we have a platform that does creativity, technology, and if it walks and breathes in the digital entertainment world, we can provide the things it needs, is the business mantra.
Who do you ingest the music for? Because, I mean, I've seen this, for example, on Spotify, where if I find an old 1970s album, sometimes the picture of the album, you can tell someone's just scanned it in. It literally looks like a scan of the actual artwork.
There's an interesting point there, sort of slight tangent, but a lot of the digital assets that exist in the industry today are actually scanned and encoded versions of analog. There, I shan't name them, but there are record labels, and the majority of the back catalogue they have on Spotify is actually encoded CDs that have been digitized because they didn't have the original.
So
masters.
Just like I used to do in the late 90s, so they just put a CD in a ripping thing and so then just sent it to Spotify.
Sometimes I had to go out and buy the CDs, for goodness sake. There's an awful lot of digital assets which are simply encoded versions of the analog assets. So, yes, I mean, our platform will have all of those. So I can serve you album art from any album from, you know, the last 75 years, any one of 60 million tracks. But I can also serve you all of the metadata that goes with that. So that is year of release, all the basic stuff, you know, publisher, songwriter, etc., etc. But on top of that, for most of my catalogue, I can tell you what mood that song would fit. I can tell you what other songs would be like that. You know, all the things that you're familiar with in the digital world, if you're a user of Spotify or Apple Music or Deezer. And our business is to provide those services to people who want to be in the digital music game. Now, those people will not be people who want to be Spotify. One of the misnomers about the digital music industry at the moment is connected to what I said earlier about it becoming like radio. There are 160 million people today paying to stream music from the streaming music services. Today, 3 billion people will listen to music for free on the radio. The interesting thing to me is, when that listening goes digital, how will that happen? And the best example I can give you of that today is an Amazon Echo. Amazon Echo is transforming the way people stream music, because you just say to an Amazon Echo, play me jazz, and it plays you 20 jazz songs. That's just like the radio. So that's the original vision of how streamed music will become a lean-back experience, will become a heavily curated, as we call it. In other words, the list is being provided by somebody else, not by you. But the vast majority of people who want to listen to music want to listen to it like that. They don't want to pull up a smartphone and a menu and a search bar and build a playlist. You know, people who are really engaged in technology and music, and there are 160 million of them, who also want to pay 120 quid a year, those people will do that, and that's terrific. And those people are probably people, and I'm guessing you're one of them, Paul, who would have gone down the record shop every Saturday and bought a single. But actually,
it's only so I could meet girls, though.
Oh, did that work?
Well, I'm a looker now, but back then I wasn't. I had my teeth done, it didn't work then, but it would work now.
You just meet girls that were interested in music like you. But actually, it's a little known fact that only 20-25% of the music consumed in the old physical world was ever bought from record shops. Most of it was cover mount CDs, mail order, supermarket checkout, you know, the Love Songs collection, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because actually, people really engaged with music went to record shops, and people really engaged with music spent more than 30 quid a year. The average spend on music in the UK has always hovered between 30 and 35 pounds a year, not 120. So the point I'm making in a rather elongated fashion is that the mass market for music has not become digital yet, and it will. And that will become digital because, for example, the next car you buy will have a connected dashboard and you will sit in the seat and you will say, actually, I fancy some jazz, and the jazz will play. Or you will be listening to
a
radio
station.
I can do that
now, through Apple CarPlay.
You can do it through Apple CarPlay and you sync to your phone.
Yeah.
And
but it's not the car.
But do you know what percentage of people, and I can tell you this because we did some research into it in the last quarter of last year, what percentage of people sync their phone to listen to music in the car? 2%. It's not most people. Most people get in their Ford and push the button that says Radio 1 or Capital or Classic. That's how they listen to radio in the car. You're engaged, interested in music and knowledgeable about technology.
In fact, my car even plays the music I was just listening to in the house because as a minute there's a Bluetooth connection, it auto plays what was already going on.
Terrific. And you've got Apple Music, so you're an enthusiast and, you know, you're one of 50 million people who has Apple Music, which is not many. That's great. But actually, when your Ford is connected, Ford won't need to use Apple Music to do that because Ford could actually do that themselves. What they'll need is somebody to supply them with the catalogue of music, the access to the radio stations, the ability to link the music that's playing on the radio to what you might want to stream. So, for example, we're working with DTS, who provide a lot of in-car audio systems, on a system at the moment where you can simply like songs as you're listening to them on the radio. I like that, I like that, I like that. And then you can say, play me all my likes. And your dashboard will play you back all the songs that you liked when you were listening to Capital or Radio 2 or whatever. Now, to me, for as a lean-back consumer, that's what you want out of digital music, because that's you using the radio station to curate a playlist for you. It's having somebody to help you collate a list of songs that you'll want to listen to, and most people need that.
There's different types of curation, though, isn't there? Because, I mean, I listen to Six Music. I think it's a great station. For my sins, I listen to Steve Wright's Sunday Morning Love Songs as well, mm-hmm. of a Sunday morning. But if you take Six Music, for example, I can listen to the actual show live with someone speaking in between the tracks, or I can go on Spotify and go to the Six Music official playlist and listen to exactly the same songs in the same order, but without a person speaking in between them. And I switch between them, if I'm honest.
And you're paying $9.99 for that privilege.
Absolutely.
So it's like quite a lot to do that, isn't it?
Absolutely. But like, if you say Sunday Morning Love Songs, right, I actually don't want to just listen to the songs because it comes a bit cheesy. Actually, Steve Wright, you know, long in the tooth though he is, his banter and all the weddings and everything he announces is actually adds to the experience because it's a bit of a shared loving.
And I think one of the interesting things about the move to, you know, new digital platforms over the last 6-7 years in both audio and video is you look at the way terrestrial television has been taken apart by digital television and by online. I mean, taken apart. It's a big Saturday evening show on ITV is 4.5 million people now.
It's nothing.
It was 12 million people. Actually, look at that radio listening figure. The reach of radio in the UK has not moved in that period. Now, slightly less listening, especially amongst younger groups, but actually reasonably marginal. You know, average time spent listening to music stations has gone, you know, in the worst case scenario from sort of at the top it used to be 11 hours a week and now in some demographics it's 6 or 7. But the people are still listening and radio has still got the attention of 90% of the British public every week. That's something ITV can't claim anymore. And I think what that shows you is that radio still has a place in this new music firmament, and it's exactly the place you just described. It's having somebody not just to pick a list of great love songs on Sunday morning, and Sunday morning is when you want to listen to love songs. You won't probably want to do that on Tuesday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Absolutely not, and anyone who does needs to be shot.
And again, but again, that's not what a Spotify or an Apple Music does. It plays you the same. You've got the same songs all the time, and if you open a playlist on Spotify, it's the same playlist at 2 o'clock in the afternoon as it is at 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's wrong. That's not how most people consume music. And so, you know, your radio listening gives you the songs that somebody else is choosing for you, and they're remembering songs you couldn't possibly have remembered, but it also gives you the personality of the presenter. Now, interestingly, in American radio, what's happened, and American radio has been much more badly damaged by the oncome of competitive services. And in America, you've got Pandora, which is radio-like streamed music online. at commercial radio listening has moved sharply down in North America, and their reaction to it has actually been to take costs out of the business, which means taking those very presenters out that are the reason you
why
listen.
People have tuned in.
So actually, I was in San Francisco a week before last, and you know, I had a very favourite radio station in San Francisco called Coit, which is the adult contemporary leader. You listen to Coit now at 10 o'clock at night, it's just a computer-driven list of records. That's all it is. And you think, well, actually, I can do that on my phone, you know. So they've managed to take themselves into the place of their less good competitor, rather than this marketplace. The UK, I think, is protected, is not too strong a word, is protected by the BBC and by a license fee funded public service broadcasting environment. And I don't want to get, you know, political or seem to be necessarily over defensive of the status quo, because you know I'm very much in the business of the changing environment, but I think the BBC is such a cherished gem, and is responsible invisibly for so much of what we hold dear here in terms of our ability to understand content and to consume content and to be more sophisticated about content than many other places in the world. It's also, incidentally, probably one of the reasons, and not the BBC, but that culture is probably one of the reasons why Britain outpaces the rest of the world by a king's mile in any songwriting, performing, any music skill. Producing, engineering, songwriting, performing, the lot. You know, Britain boxes so far above its weight. You know, I was really interested. I was watching the Olympics from South Korea, and you look at the ice dancing and the music, and I think I was counting the songs. It must have been 75% of the music that every nation was dancing to was British. And you think, wow, you know, we may not be winning many medals, but by God, you know, we got the one for music. And that is because we have a culture in this country which lends itself to those creative skills. And when we're at our very best, we are mixing that creative ability with technology innovation, which we also have in this country, to create genuinely innovative creative products. It's why the movie industry spends a lot of its time in the UK with special effects and with production design and all sorts of those sides of the movie industry, because we have the technology and the creative skills to use the technology properly.
Do you not feel a tiny bit sorry for, say, Global, though, where they're competing against the BBC? I mean, would you rather be the controller of Five Live or LBC or, you know, XFM or One Extra? Because, you know, on both sides of that, one side has a much larger budget.
Well, I enjoyed a nice glass of wine the other night with Richard Park, who's the group editorial director at Global, and he's feeling very happy about his job. So no, I don't think there's any way in which that's a problem business to be in. Competing with the BBC is tough, yes. But tough competition provides great results. If you're a commercial radio company in the UK, you have to compete with a free-to-air, non-commercially funded competitor.
You have to be pretty good.
You have to be bloody good. And they are. You know, and that's why commercial radio enjoys a better share than the BBC. They manage that competition. Now, if they didn't have the BBC to compete with, boy, they would not be anything like as good, because they'd be able to do what American commercial radio has done and follow the lowest common denominator all the way down, because everybody was doing the same thing. And I think I travel a lot now with this job, and I hear a lot of commercial radio in lots of places around the world, and I think we have first-rate commercial radio now in this country. And incidentally, I think Global, also from the point of view of technological innovation and embracing the digital future, is head and shoulders above most other radio companies in the world. There are two or three radio companies. I'd call out Talpa in the Netherlands as well. They happen to be a customer of Seven Digitals. But you know, they're providing services which link radio and streamed music in the same way that Global are. And therefore, they're embracing the way this medium is going to develop. They're not just sitting back and going, well, it's about 30-second commercials and the breakfast show. They're looking at where the business is going to go. And again, I think that's because they're in an environment where if they didn't do that, they've got the BBC iPlayer, so, you know, they've got to compete with that.
So what's a typical week for you then? What do you actually do?
I'm not sure there is such a thing as a typical week, Paul, to be honest. I travel a lot in this job, so this week has been Paris and Amsterdam, both with clients. Last week,
I've done Great Yarmouth, Cleethorpes.
Sorry, that sounded like I was bragging. And actually, there's no brag about it because, you know, it's exhausting a lot of the time.
I'm sat in departure lounges all the time.
Yeah.
It's not glamorous, is it?
Well, it's seat 42L in the middle of the middle row. That's the one, you know, when I'm in the departure lounge. My job is about two things, essentially. It's about making sure that the company runs smoothly, and we'll come back to how that happens. And it's about winning customers in this business. I mean, I've always been a chief executive that has led from the sales front. You know, I enjoy selling. I enjoy clients. I enjoy, you know, creating business. That's what has always given me a buzz since the first day we formed, you know, Unique, Tim Blackmore and I, back in 1989 and sold our first live concert, the Eurythmics, from Rome to Continental Airlines, who sponsored it. That,
wow.
You know, I still remember the meeting where we sold that.
I still have a Eurythmics playlist on Spotify. Annie Lennox's voice is still unbelievable.
I'm sure she won't mind me saying this, but I have an Airbnb rental in West London, and she was a tenant of mine 2 years ago while her house was being redone. And she's a lovely, lovely lady, yes.
Did she give you a good reference on Airbnb?
She gave us a 5-star review, yes. But not under her name, I don't think.
I can imagine. Anyway.
So I go around the world creating business for the company, and I love that. And seriously, the change in the last 4 years since, you know, UBC Media Unique became Seven Digital is that I run a business now which is operating on four continents, and we have 60 customers in all sorts of jurisdictions. And that's really stimulating, looking at different business cultures, looking at the way markets are developing in other places in the world is absolutely fascinating. And I wish I'd done that earlier in my career, to be honest. You know, having been in the radio industry all my life, the radio industry in this country is very focused on this country and not very focused on anything else. And it gives you quite an insular point of view about, you know, the world, especially the business world and the media world. And my eyes have been opened in the last 4 years. So I do that. And then in my spare time, I have to make sure the company runs properly. No, luckily, I have a great team of senior managers who look after the operation of the company. But obviously, you know, my job often is to talk to staff, to have weekly management meetings, to make sure we're on target to do what we said we're going to do. We're not spending too much money. We're earning the right amount of money. The mice have been dealt with in the kitchen. You know, that kind of big deal.
All the glamorous stuff. And do you enjoy the kind of business side of it, the managerial side of it, or do you see it as a means to an end? I mean, like, I do my VAT return because I have to. I don't want to go to prison, but I don't enjoy it.
I don't enjoy my tax return.
Actually, that's a really bad example.
Is there anybody who enjoys that? If you meet that person, then, you know, their friends are in telephone boxes. Yes. Do I enjoy the management side of it? It is slightly a means to an end, and I guess that's why I enjoy it. But I do enjoy it, and one of the nice things about the way you develop, I think, through a business career is you get to know the things you're not good at, the things you don't enjoy, and the things you can't do. Those are much more important than to learn the things you can do and the things you do enjoy, because that's really easy. And then you surround yourself with people who do those things that you're not very good at, because then, as a whole, you're much better. And I have to surround myself with good finance people, because I'm, you know, one of my great skills is not attention to detail. So, you know, yes, I'll spend 10 minutes looking at a set of figures and I'll have a finance director explain them to me, but I need to trust that he's going to look after the detail because I'm not going to, you know, work backwards from the balance sheet to the cash flow and, you know, and make sure that it still looks great in August. So my aptitude for business is very much driven by business winning and by the top line. And I have here a fantastic chief operating officer who is one of those human beings who just makes the trains run on time, you know, and I need that because I wouldn't be able to do that anything like as well as Paul does. What I've managed to pick the bits of running the business that I think I'm good at and that I like, and leave some of the other stuff to other people. So I don't have to do an enormous amount of stuff that I'm either not good at or I don't enjoy. And I think that's important. I mean, it's not just because, you know, your job is to develop a business life where it's all fun. That's not right. But if you're doing things that you have an aptitude for, then you'll do them more successfully. It's as simple as that.
Without being too self-congratulatory, as it were, because this isn't a fawning question, but what is it that you bring to the role of chief executive that's made you succeed? Because I work with a lot of chief executives, and it's not necessarily, as you've said, about skills. It's more of a sense of drive, of commitment and ambition. Are you a competitive person? What is it about your temperament that's made you be so successful?
Well, thank you for saying I'm successful. I think success is very subjective. I feel I've achieved some of the things I set out to achieve. So that's my measure of success. Equally, I feel there are some things I haven't achieved yet. So to go to your point about competitiveness, I'm competitive like that. I'm competitive with myself, and I'm certainly competitive with other companies. I think it is really important to have strong competitors in your industry. And one of the paradoxically bad things about the last 2 years is that Seven Digital's biggest competitor, after we created the company 4 years ago, went bust about a year later. And they were a company that was really difficult to compete with. They were sharp, they were good. They made a couple of bad business judgments and went out of business. And that was a bad day. A bad day anyway, because it is always bad to see a group of human beings, you know, who are employed by a company that goes into administration. But a bad day because it lost the sharpness of a lot of people here. Great, life's great now, you know, they've gone, and that's bad. You know, you've got to counter that. So I am competitive, and I think that is one of the important parts of being a chief executive. But if I might slightly duck the question, I don't think there's any such thing as a great chief executive, even a great chief executive of a media company, because to go back to what I said before, there are great chief executives who are great at the following things, but those greatnesses will only be shown if they surrounded themselves by people who do the other things. So, for example, some chief executives like me are very sales driven. Great. So I could say it's really important to be a chief executive that's sales driven. But it isn't, because actually I know loads of chief executives who don't really like sales, but they run a really tight ship. They're much better at the organizational stuff, and they employ a fantastic commercial director who goes out and kicks down doors and earns revenue. I think if there's one quality that is common, if I can try and answer your question properly rather than duck it, I think it's that simple quality of leadership. I think a chief executive has to have her or his staff believe in them, believe in what they believe, and, you know, go over the hill together. Now, inevitably, you'll never do that with all of your staff. But if you can try and lead by example, explain what you're trying to achieve, sell to your staff the reason we're trying to achieve it, get them to believe in it, you will have a much more engaged group of human beings who are much more productive and, you know, a happier working environment. And I think that's a really important job of a chief executive, to lead in that respect.
Do you have any unfulfilled ambitions, both commercially as CEO in your current role, or do you want to do this for another 5 years, jack it in and then open up a nursery, garden or children?
Well, there's about 10 questions there. Have I achieved everything we've got to achieve? No. We have told our investors that we will be profitable this year, and that is what we told people 4 years ago we would do in 2018. So that is the number one focus. And we concluded a big transaction last year with a big new customer and shareholder called MediaMark Saturn, who economically have transformed the business. And that leads us to believe we will be profitable this year. by the middle of this year. And that's an important thing that we've promised investors. It's an important thing because I promised it to myself. The staff have had it on their radar for the last 18 months. So that is something we have yet to achieve and we will achieve. More broadly, I think I would like to see achieved the beginnings of the digital music industry that I talked about earlier. I'd like to see digital music emerge from being, you know, a $9.99 a month Model T Black Ford to being how people consume music in all different types.
So what would that look like?
Well, it's beginning to look already. It would look like, well...
You mentioned the car.
Yeah, but do you have an Amazon Echo at home?
I don't.
Okay, so I'd urge you to get one. And I would say that if you get one, whatever room you put it in, you'll never use a radio in that room again. And every room you put one in, you won't need a radio. But also, you won't need Spotify. Because it just, you know, plays you music or it plays you the radio, it plays you whatever you ask it for. And it's a completely different thing. And if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, you think that's all happening for free because you're paying Prime for your delivery. Sorry to go on about Amazon's mm-hmm. business model, and they're not a customer of ours, so I'm not pushing one of our customers. But I think they are one of the most innovative companies in the world. So people listening to music that way sort of think they're not paying for it. They are, of course, paying for it. Now, go back to your Ford. You know, perhaps, I mean, if you get a Tesla today, it comes with music. At the moment, it comes with Spotify. Elon Musk has said publicly he's going to stop that and he's going to create his own Tesla music service. But I'm quite sure the Tesla will come with the music included as part of the price of the car. So he's, you know, the car's got a 5-year life before you pass it on to the next person. That's costing him, I don't know, $80 a year to pay record labels for a service in Tesla's. Fine. That's a bit like, you know, giving people a leather ashtray, isn't it? It's not going to cost them a fortune more. So the economic model will become that music is sort of there on a range of devices and things that come with it, rather than you having to load a service that you put your credit card in and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, MediaMarkt Saturn, one of our big customers, they have, 3.5 million loyalty card holders in Germany. And what they want to do is they want to give all their loyalty card holders music, because Amazon Prime customers have music and they believe Amazon is their biggest competitor. And they're right. Every retailer in the world has Amazon as a competitor. But, you know, take Dixon's in the UK. Every time they sell an Amazon Echo in a Dixon store, they're effectively selling a cash register to their competitor, because you get the Amazon Echo home, the next TV you buy, you can buy with that, or you can buy with Amazon.
Well, I mean, I don't buy DVDs anymore, but I can remember sort of even as recently as 7 or 8 years ago, I would be in HMV on Oxford Street and I would get season 3 of Breaking Bad as a box set in HMV. I'd pick it up, scan the barcode on the Amazon app, and it'd say, well, we can get you that for £13 cheaper delivered tomorrow. Yeah. And I'd just click one button and then it'd be there.
Yeah, but now if you've got...
They call it showrooming, don't they?
Yeah, but now if you've got an Echo at home, you don't even need to do that. You just go, I want the box set of that, and it arrives in the post the next day. So, you know, when Dixon sell you the Amazon Echo, they're selling you something that can do that. So that's a nightmare. So MediaMarkt Saturn believe they've got to stop doing that. So they've got to start selling wireless speakers in their stores, which have their own music service on it and which allow you to shop with them, not with Amazon. And that's the only way, goes back to the point we were making earlier about competition. The only way you compete is to look at what the guy is doing who's taking your customers and do that better than they are.
It seems that the radio industry still doesn't quite know what to do, though, in terms of the various experiments. I mean, you look at, say, the government still hasn't switched off the analog signal. They seem to be
annoyed about that. We're going to do DAB.
But then also, like, if you look at Apple experimenting, we're going to do everything.
That's bad.
But Apple...
This is going to go downhill now.
But Apple, for example, are, you know, still experimenting with Beats One. They launched their station. Yep. It seems to me that there's still some lots of things being tried at the moment.
So you started that point by saying the radio industry looks to be in trouble because it's starting things. And then you gave me a terrific example in Beats 1 of why the radio industry doesn't need to worry. Because if you wanted to name the least successful radio station in the world, it would be Beats 1, without any doubt. It's a radio station which is hardwired onto billions of devices in the world and yet is listened to by a minuscule number of people. Now, what that shows you, radio is rocket science. It isn't, you know, easy. And a technology company does not find it easy to do what a great radio station does. And hiring a few people who used to work in radio doesn't do it, because basically you're still a technology company. One of the mantras I have here at Seven Digital is, we are a music company that uses technology, not a technology company that uses
music. So you start from the music point of view.
Because that's why our customers engage with us. They assume the technology just works. You know, the technology must not get in the way. Listening to Beats is a complicated thing to do. Now, you'll do it because, yes, you'll Bluetooth your phone in your car and all of that. But how many people open up Beats on their iPhone, get into the car, Bluetooth it to the car speakers, you know, and listen to it that way?
Actually, I don't play because it's shite.
Right, OK. Well, but you don't need to anyway, because you've got 6 or 7 buttons on your radio that will get you that straight away. And the music choice will be better, and the presenters will be better. And also, it'll do weird things, like it'll give you a breakfast show at breakfast in the UK rather than breakfast in California. You know, so there's all sorts of things wrong with that. And Spotify are busy trying to be radio as well. The people who've succeeded in getting closest to radio than anybody are Pandora in the US, which is a US-only service and is born out of a particular copyright thing, which I won't go into because it's extremely boring, but it only applies in the US. But they're providing effectively things that are online radio stations, streamed playlists which sound much more like radio. And it's very successful, and it's advertiser supported. They've got a premium tier as well, but the one that's successful is the advertiser supported stream. So you can do it in new technology, but the big tech companies are not turning out to do it very well. Now, to come back to your point about radio, one of the things that frustrates me about the industry I spent my life in, and in case you've missed it, I still love, is it's almost the same, and this happens if you look at most industries in transition. Certainly it's happening in retail. We talked about Amazon's advantages over Dixon's Carphone. But actually, Dixon's Carphone has got loads of advantages over Amazon, which is probably that it has more footfall through its stores than Amazon has customers every day. So look at the advantages you have and work out how to use those advantages to compete. Radio has enormous skills and advantages in this world. First of all, it has what technology companies would call an installed base of, in this country, about 56 million people. In other words, who listen to it every day. And your average radio station, you know, take Radio 2, it has an installed base, in inverted commas, of 7 or 8 million people. Now, that's bigger than Spotify.
Massive.
And actually, if you take, and we did this in some research last year, if you take a listening map of the UK, in other words, not a funding music map, but a map of how people listen to music, and you plot the digital music services against other people's music listening. We used AudienceNet to do that, a very statistically robust 10,000 sample. First of all, the entire digital music industry represents 15% of listening to music. And secondly, Spotify is slightly smaller than Radio 2 in terms of the amount of listening to music that goes on. Now, therefore, the radio industry has an enormous opportunity to play in this game, because it is clearly doing some of the things that people want. What it has to do is move those people into a digital environment. Companies like Global and Talpa and, you know, a couple of other companies in the world are beginning to do that. You know, so the Capital Radio app, which allows you, when you're listening to a song on the radio and you don't like that song, you can swipe the song. So you can go round the Capital Radio playlist. So that's effectively making the radio station like a playlist in your pocket. I think that's really cool. And a lot of people would say, well, that'll do for me, because actually they play all the songs I want. So, you know, that's my digital music. And maybe you can charge people 99 cents a month for that. Maybe you can support it by advertising, whatever. But it moves the game on, and it uses the advantages that radio has to compete with its new competitors who think they're Spotify and Apple, but actually those people are competing very badly with radio.
I mean, I remember that Absolute had that innovation, didn't they, where Christian O'Connell would effectively present seven different shows in real time, and you could listen to him via playing the 80s, the 90s, or rock, yeah, or whatever. And sometimes, even if you were on the easy listening version, you could actually hear, you know, Guns N' Roses' Paradise City in his headphones as he was now saying, oh, that was great, Axl Rose was great on that. And I'm thinking, no, that was Valdunican that you just played.
Back to Sunday Love Songs now.
Exactly.
Yeah, and Absolute were one of the companies that innovated in this space.
I mean, if you think about it, it's a very clever idea.
Yeah, and that was Clive Dickens leading that at Absolute. Yeah, they were ahead of their time and probably got criticised for being ahead of their time. A lot of what Absolute did 5-6 years ago is kind of coming to pass now. But yeah, radio stations need to do more of that kind of thing. And to me, that's what digital is about. That's what digital radio is about, not a DAB transmission of the same thing that I'm doing on FM, and I've just doubled my transmission costs and earned no new revenue. How does that model work? You know, that's the problem there. If you're going to do something digital, it has to be attached to some new form of revenue, some form of extending your revenue, extending your listening, you know, doing something to get you from where you are today to where you want to be tomorrow.
I mean, the BBC are one of your clients, and they've said that they plan to outsource 60% of radio production by 2022.
Yep.
Is that a big opportunity for you?
I have to surprisingly say no. You know, I've been involved in independent production since 1987, actually. And Tim Blackmore and I started Unique, which was at the time, you know, one of the first production companies. So, yeah, I speak with some history. The extension of outsourcing is absolutely the right thing to do. And there's been one principle which the BBC has now adopted. And, you know, congratulations to the current Director General, although, you know, more credit due to people like Bob Shannon, who internally have led the push towards independent production.
Bob's been a guest on this podcast. He's
right,
a great guy.
I must listen to his podcast. I have listened
to
it.
And you should listen to John Myers as well. He was fantastic.
Well,
legend.
A legendary mate of mine, a great mate of mine. But the principle is not about independent production or non-independent production. It's about spending the licence fee on the best material wherever it comes from. That should be the guiding principle of the BBC. And for the BBC for so many years to arrogantly assume that the best people to make radio programs were people who had a BBC staff number was quite ridiculous. And they've got rid of that idea now, which is great. So I think ethically, if you like, that's absolutely the right thing. Will it be a great business opportunity? Not necessarily, because the BBC's got a certain amount of money to spend and it hasn't got any more money to spend. And
it's got less money to spend,
yeah,
these
and it's
days.
going to spread the same jam thinner, you know, and therefore, and what we see in our production business is we're being asked to do the same thing for less or more for the same, and that's okay. It's kind of what we expected to happen. It's why we took the production businesses and created a much bigger business, because now our, you know, 40 or so very talented production staff sit within a bigger company that makes money in lots of other ways. We make money in production, but we don't need to rely on it to drive. It's not the economic engine of the company. What I want that creative team to do, and they're beginning to do now, is what I said to you earlier about the radio industry needs to do. You know, the production business is a really important part of Seven Digital, but if I were a production business on my own, I would be fooling myself if I thought the extension of compete and compare, you know, to 60% was going to make me rich overnight. It isn't. It's probably going to mean that I'm producing more hours, but it probably won't mean that I'm making a lot more money.
FM, I'm led to believe, stands for frequency modulation. I learned that this morning.
And AM stands for
amplitude modification. Oh, I got that wrong. But
and shortwave stands for?
SW. Do you think they'll ever switch FM off?
I can't see them switching FM off, as in the whole of FM.
Because I haven't listened to an FM station in years.
Is that true?
Probably.
You've listened to FM stations, but you've listened to them
Not on FM, on DAB or online.
Yeah, okay. And if you didn't have a DAB radio, what would you do?
I'd just kill myself.
No, you'd listen to them online.
Yeah, would you?
So I think FM will continue as long as there are people who are listening on it, and there's still, you know, 50-odd% of the population who are listening on
grandparents.
FM. Well, and it's not just grandparents, you know, it's people in cars that are more than 7 years old, and there are a lot of those. Some people are 29 and driving 7-year-old cars,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, FM is so much part of the way people listen to the radio that it's difficult to imagine it being switched off. And, you know, never say never. But, you know, long wave was going to be switched off for so many years.
And it's Radio 4 still doing it,
it's
aren't
still
they?
There. Well, they still do various things that are only broadcast on long wave. I think it's Test Match Special on long wave and some DAB channel. I don't know. But so, you know, it takes an awful long time before a bandwidth will get to a position where you can switch it off. And as long as it's there, sadly, most radio stations will need to still be on it. And then you get into, okay, so will some radio switch off? Well, a commercial radio station would only switch off its FM when it thought there was nobody listening to it, because otherwise it would be suicide, because the FM FM transmission costs an awful lot less than, you know, the other transmissions. So, you know, it's the cheapest of the lot. So you would leave it there until you'd only got 10 people listening on it. And that will be a long time. I mean, 10, 15, 20 years.
It's incredible. I was in we rented a holiday cottage last year, and my niece, who's 12, we were listening to the FM radio in the cottage.
So you said you hadn't listened to FM before, yeah.
And there was a little bit of interference, and she didn't understand that because she's used to DAB, because it's digital, it either works or it doesn't. And if it works, it works perfectly. And if the signal degrades, it just goes off completely.
And it doesn't
work.
She
was like, what's that? A partial bit of signal and some static?
She might have thought that was better than the DAB not being on at all. But let's not go there. You know, I've got bruises all over my body from DAB. I was a former chairman of the Digital Radio Development Board and, you know, was in the radio industry at the point DAB came in. We owned two digital radio stations at one point. We owned a station called One Word, which was one of the first stations on Digital One. We owned a network of oldies stations called Classic Gold, which was on AM but available on DAB, and the vision was that people would buy DAB radios and they would move over. We were way, way ahead of our time, and the sale of digital radios in the UK cannot be called anything other than disappointing.
A disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let you say that. And that is all to do with an inability to invest in the product. The radio industry wouldn't do anything to bring the price of digital radios down. It wouldn't invest in the chipsets. It wouldn't invest in the manufacturers, because it never had done, and it didn't think that was part of its business model. But, you know, we needed a $9.99 digital radio 8-9 years ago. That would have kickstarted a move. The problem now is that, as you said earlier, you can stream radio or you can listen to it in DAB, and, you know, the growth of streaming is likely soon to outpace the growth of DAB listening, especially as people get those connected cars, you know, and in the end car manufacturers will go, well actually, why are we bother putting an FM chip or a DAB chip in? If the cars can stream, then we don't need either of those. We'll just stream off 4G or LTE or 5G.
So would Ford, for example, would they invest in a Ford Mustang radio channel that might play rock and roll and a few, Americana type stuff?
Absolutely. You mean you're in your Mustang and you've got a channel called Mustang?
Yeah.
Absolutely, they might. Yeah.
And might that be the future for your business, where you would curate something like that, where you would provide Ford?
We're doing a service for Fender at the moment, which is guitar-led music. Yes, that would absolutely be it. And I have to be careful what I say specifically about Ford. But yes, that would be the kind of thing we would do. Let's put it like that.
So last question then. I noticed that you brought your crystal ball. Thank you ever so much for that. If you could just gaze into it longingly for the moment, where do you think the industry will be in sort of 15, 20 years from now? And, you know, given, if you can imagine all the income streams that you have as a pie chart, you know, you've got a bit of radio production and all the various curation services, how will that pie chart change, say, 20 years from now? What will you be doing more of? What will you be doing less of?
So if I define the industry as the music consumption industry, and where will it be in,
say, 15, 20 years from now?
15, 20 years.
Because we'll all be in hover cars and
15, 20
lasers
years,
at each other.
Most of the music that comes into our ears will be digital in one form or another in 15 years. We will think it very amusing that we used to control everything we did by touching a screen and by commands that involved using our fingers, because we will not use our hands to control anything. We probably won't use our hands to type or to enter commands or even to write instant messages, which will by then probably have completely replaced email. So our interface with technology will have become a lot more seamless, a lot easier. Our interface with music will be about the consumption of more music. Music will be available in places where it currently isn't. And it will be about intelligent devices which sense what music you want at any particular time and have the ability both to surprise you with something you didn't expect but you like, and equally play you something that it knows that wherever you are knows you're going to want now. So you simply say, to go back to your own music habits, you simply say on Sunday morning when you wake up, start the music. And music that is the kind that Steve Wright plays starts. And perhaps Steve Wright is part of that. Perhaps he isn't. Perhaps you can say, you know, give me Steve Wright, and suddenly you get him in between the songs, and then the next hour you don't want him in between the songs.
What about the commerciality of it, though? Because at the moment I pay Spotify $9.99, mm-hmm. but if I listen to XFM, there's going to be adverts in between Chris Moyles and records.
Yeah, well, you don't pay Spotify $9.99 for Steve Wright's Sunday Love songs.
No, I pay the license fee.
Correct. So it might be that the BBC gives you some of these things. The BBC has announced that it intends to be in streaming music by the end of this year. So, and there's, I shouldn't say too much about that, but you know, I expect they will be. Let's put it like that. The idea that you will pay one company for digital music is also not going to be the way it is. You know, we're already at that place in video. You know, most people have got Netflix, Amazon. They're paying a Sky or a Virgin subscription. Actually, there's the same database of movies available on most of those, and they're paying multiple times for it, but they don't look at it like that, because one of them's Amazon Prime, the other one's part of my Sky subscription. Oh, well, I need that for these things, for the football, so I might as well have the movies as well, etc., etc. And I think music will be the same. There'll be a whole range of economic ways that you engage, and to your point, advertising will be one of them. And yes, you know, the music will be interrupted by commercials sometimes, but you know, commercial radio survived very nicely in the world for the last 75 years. And it's always the reason people say, and, you know, I was, as you pointed out at the beginning of this piece, I was program director of a commercial radio station for a few years back in the 80s. And, you know, when you ask people who don't listen to commercial radio why they don't, they always say the adverts. But when you talk to people who do listen to commercial radio about whether they notice the adverts, they always say no. You know, it's the reason
neither's good.
it's the reason people think they don't listen, but it actually isn't the reason they don't listen. They don't listen because they like something else more. Commercials have never stopped people listening. And in certain environments, having commercials in between music is absolutely fine.
Last question then, in two parts. Please answer them in order so we can end on a high note. What's been the worst business day of your career so far? And then to end on, what's been the best day?
The worst business day, and I'm not going to tell you when it was, but thankfully it's only ever happened once, was a day when we had to pay the salaries tomorrow and I wasn't sure we were going to be able to.
We've all been there.
When we were a lot smaller. And that's the most terrible feeling of having let down, you know, a number of people. Happily, it didn't happen. But definitely that was the worst. That's a dreadful feeling. So to the best business day. The best day. I'm gonna pick a slightly odd one. And you know, luckily, and it's the most fortunate thing about my life, there are a lot of great days I could quote. And I'm incredibly lucky to have been blessed by, you know, some good fortune and some had some great days. We had a 10th anniversary party for Unique in 1999, and we hired the Cafe Royal, and we had everybody who was anybody in the radio industry. And at the time, we had about 45, 50 staff. And I still have the photograph taken on that day of all our staff at the Café Royal on my office wall. And it was a proud day on the day, but it's still a proud day today because if I look at those people, amongst them are the managing directors of three or four other production companies today, some very senior people in the industry, an awful lot of young people who went on to succeed. And that particular time in our history, 1999, we were right at the centre of a really burgeoning industry, and we were fortunate enough to have some really talented young people. So it was a great time to be there, and I'll never forget that night. But as I look back on it, it was a great time because its success endured, if you like, and is still there today in the success of some of those people who came through our door.
Simon, you're a legend. Thank you.
Thank you.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.